Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices, a very sobering United Nations study on the state of the global environment said that almost a quarter of the world's mammals face extinction within 30 years. Human activities, notably the destruction of habitats and the introduction of alien species from one part of the world into another, are identified as the main cause of this loss in biodiversity. Yes, and we agree on Animal Voices that the Earth today stands in imminent peril, and nothing short of a planetary rescue will save it from the environmental cataclysm of dangerous climate change. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Our webpage, and with thanks to John Pranger, our webmaster, our webpage is kept up to date. It's www.animalvoices.org. Thank you, Alan Jensen, for always being in the control room. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today, we have co-host John Pranger. Over to you, John.
Hello, and we always fight the good fight against vivisection and say that no product can be certified safe through animal experimentation. Actually, what it does, it deceives the very consumers whom they're supposed to protect by certifying as safe household products and cosmetics that cause nearly 200,000 hospital-recorded poisonous exposures annually in the United States only. So far from bringing us safe products, they actually bring us deleterious and dangerous products.
Thank you, John. So, and also we have in the studio today is two guests, one of them being Eleanor Boyle. Thank you for coming back in again.
Thanks,
Eleanor,
Carl.
What will you be doing today on Animal Voices?
I'd like to continue the conversation that we started here 2 weeks ago, in which we outlined some of the problems of the livestock industry for climate change. And today in our conversation, I'd like to focus on what we can all do and then think about effective advocacy and how we can be effective in spreading what we consider an important message.
Over to you shortly, but before that, Alart, tell us what you will be doing today.
I'm going to be talking a little bit about language, our choice of language, the words we use, and how that reveals our attitudes towards animals and, of course, to each other.
So at the half-hour mark today, we will be contacting Howard Lyman, the author of Mad Cowboy and the book No More Bull. And we will be discussing agricultural practices with particular reference to topsoil destruction. Well, over to you, Eleanor. We've been blessed with your company on Animal Voices a number of times, and you're a writer, a food activist, and involved with many health-related aspects. So maybe you'd like to just give us that little summary that you promised us from a carry-on from last week, from 2 weeks ago.
There's a lot of talk about climate change these days, and that's a good thing. One of the pieces of the puzzle that tends to be missing is the involvement of the livestock industry or meat production and consumption and its role in climate change. When we hear discussions of climate change, we usually hear how much less we should drive our cars, and that's important. But a number of very important studies, including a large one out of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization about a year ago, made the very strong point that meat production is probably the number one cause of climate change. And it's really shocking to imagine, but it's actually, according to the FAO, the United Nations organization, it's actually a larger factor than transport. Another really important study out of the University of Chicago followed this up and showed that you're actually doing more for the environment by becoming vegan than you are by switching to a Prius. So it's about the role of meat production in climate change, and I always jump immediately to say we don't all have to become vegetarian if we cannot do that, but there are things that we can do.
Some of my best friends are not vegetarian, you know, but this climate change and the livestock production is all encompassing. It's many different aspects of why it's so much energy is being used to produce a pound of chicken, a pound of pig, a pound of beef.
Exactly. And those of us who've been vegetarian for a time have been reading for years about the amount of resources of the planet that are used to make meat. And some of us know that it takes at least 5 kilograms and sometimes up to 20 to produce 1 kilogram of meat. That sort of argument, that's really important. But recently, we've come to see through these very detailed and rigorous studies that have been done that meat production is not only has negative environmental effects of a variety of types, but is actually causing climate change. And there are two main ways in which it's doing it, and one is deforestation. The meat production is the number one driver of deforestation. It's rather shocking, but most of the Amazon that has been cut down is now pasture or feed crop land to grow corn and soy to feed cattle and pigs so that we can have steak and pork chops. It's a fairly direct link. And, of course, the second way in which the livestock industry contributes to climate change is through gas production. The gases that are produced by animals, by manure, etc., have a lot of global warming potential.
This is the methane that's released from the waste materials. Is that what's decomposing
Exactly. There are really three main gases that come out of the livestock industry, and one is carbon dioxide because there's a lot of fossil fuels used in meat production. But specific to the livestock industry is methane and also nitrous oxide, which most people haven't heard of, which emanates from the very large quantities of manure, which, by the way, are so copious that we do not know what to do with them, and they appear to be, according to the United Nations, one of the major sources of water pollution worldwide. Nitrous oxide has almost 300 times the global warming potential of carbon dioxide. So these little-known gases are very important to climate change.
Now, we're producing gigantic quantities of corn, and we're gigantic quantities of soya, which are in turn being fed to animals. What percentages are you aware of? What percentages of all the corn we grow and all the wheat is being fed to animals? What's the turnaround like? I mean, this is part of the problem, isn't it?
That's a really good question. In fact, I'm not sure of the exact numbers. I have read that over 50% of the grain and pulses that are grown in North America, over 50% are fed to livestock, but I'm actually not exactly sure of the number.
So now they're using tractors and fertilizers to grow the products, but we feed them to animals, and which also is they, many of them need to be kept in environmentally enclosed, climate controlled areas, which is also fossil fuel intensive usage.
The problem is not small-scale meat production from an environmental point of view, exactly as you say, Carl. The problem is these intensive livestock operations, or ILOs, which not only are, by any standard, cruel to the animals, but which are very fossil fuel dependent. In fact, as an aside, don't produce any jobs, but have environmental effects that are particularly problematic.
You're talking about feedlots?
Feedlots, and then the intensive livestock operations where tens or hundreds of thousands of animals are all confined in small areas.
Yet the FAO report says that that's not likely to change, that agribusiness needs to be accommodated and sort of integrated with small-size farming. It's not saying that it should be torn down. It's even though it's a big problem, it's suggesting technological fixes, isn't it?
In fact, that's a really good point, John. The FAO report is not nearly as radical as some people feel that it is needed. Personally, I think it is a huge contribution. It does work within the paradigm of meat eating, and as a realist, I think that's a good approach, but others might feel that it should have suggested more radical solutions. It suggested that there are technical scientific solutions that all governments could put into place right now within the paradigm of meat eating that would cut down an awful lot of the greenhouse gas production. And one of the things that I'm going to suggest that our listeners do, along with trying to eat less meat, is to work to educate our governments on insisting that the meat industry put some of these technological fixes into place. There are things like different kinds of feeds for the animals, which result in less methane production, different ways of storing the manure, so there's less nitrous oxide produced, things like this. I certainly understand your point that those aren't radical solutions, but I think they're really important ones.
Well, they're suggesting that feedlots should be placed next to grazing land, or not grazing land, but food crop land. Now, that seems to be a big mistake because we already know that E. coli is concentrated in the guts of animals that are fed in a feedlot, so you're spraying that directly onto food crops. That's one way that they're thinking it should be dealt with. That seems to me just a structural change that isn't going to make a big difference.
Well, I think that these are really complex issues that on which I am not an expert. Most of us are not. I think that our role as concerned citizens is simply to write letters to our governments, play an active role in the political process to work on the larger picture and suggest that our governments, first of all, stop subsidizing the industrial meat industry, which it does, and work toward whichever solutions their technical experts deem correct.
It's hard to be optimistic, but at the same time, if we look at what's happened around global warming in the last few years, there's been this big change in the perception, or at least the public perception, of political leaders like George Bush and the Canadian government and European governments. Where just a few years ago, they were denying there was such a thing as global warming. Absolutely. It doesn't exist, right? And if to some degree it exists, there's no human part in it anyway, so there's no point in talking about it. Now they're all being forced through public pressures, through ordinary people in large numbers, as well as academics and other people who are just not stopping to put on the pressure, that eventually it's starting to get through. And I think in terms of the issues you're talking about, it seems on the one hand remote that we'll ever get the government to agree to make any changes in agricultural practices and so on. But when you look at the small successes that we've all had in the last, just the last 5 years or so, like 5 years ago, Harper and Bush and even Tony Blair were just denying there was a problem. And now they're being forced to admit there is. And so around other areas too, maybe it is a matter of just unrelentingly putting pressure on.
Yeah, and people who've been involved in this issue for years, such as some of your listeners and some of the people here, may have found it easy to become pessimistic from time to time. But as a person who teaches psychology at the college level, I've done a lot of thinking about personal involvement in social change. And once the foundation is laid over a period of time, social change can actually occur quite quickly and can come to be widely accepted. And there are some amazing examples. How about seatbelts? Wearing seatbelts? How about no smoking in public places? How about little things like people picking up after their dogs? When I was a child playing in the parks in Vancouver, they were littered with the remains of dogs, no more. And those kinds of attitudes, which most people would agree are really positive, changed quite quickly once the groundwork had been laid by concerned citizens over a period of time.
Thanks. And you know, one of the things you were very good at covering is, we're four vegetarians here, but how best we can alienate these meat eaters. Maybe you can tell us how we can do that very effectively.
Well, now, Carl, you know I'm not going to say we should alienate everyone. In fact, first of all, what can we do? We can all try to eat less meat. We can all try to become more conscientious eaters. And in fact, a friend of mine who runs an organization in Saskatoon called Beyond Factory Farming really believes that we can be conscientious omnivores, buying locally, organically produced food, including meat, if we choose to do so. But if we want to be persuasive in speaking with people to raise their understanding of this issue, there are a couple of principles. May I run through them?
Sure.
All righty. One is, in persuasion, it's best to be likable. More likable people are actually more persuasive than unlikable people. That means, and it may sound trivial, but having a smile on your face, and it can't be phony. You have to be optimistic, and you really should adopt and cultivate in yourself a genuine attitude of compassion and caring for other people and belief that everyone really wants to do the right thing and that everyone is educable and that you may not be entirely right and you in the details of your message. You have to have some humility and some compassion for others. It's really useful, the persuasion literature says, to acknowledge both sides of an issue. When someone says to you, "But I love eating meat," it's probably more useful to acknowledge that they enjoy a chicken dinner than to deny it, acknowledging both sides of an issue. Repeating a message is always makes it more effective, but you want to state your points really clearly and briefly. And one of the most important persuasive suggestions I've ever heard is, don't lecture, initiate conversations. And it's really difficult not to just sit someone down and give them a lecture on the topic you feel so passionately about. But it's really important not to, but rather to engage them. I have not always succeeded on this point, but I try.
Maybe you have to try the Socratic method and ask questions that they know the answer to. I mean, everybody knows the answer to the questions that are raised.
I appreciate what you're saying, but I think it's really important for us, and I'm not sure you're not suggesting that we be manipulative. I think it's really important that we be really genuine and genuinely be open to their experiences and simply give them perhaps something to read, different ways of looking at things.
Is it okay to say that when they're just about to pick up that pork, what do you call them, big thing from the 10 pounds of frozen meat, ham, and you say, and you could ask them a question, is that the flesh, the factory farmed flesh from tortured animals?
Okay, Carl, I'm totally not suggesting that.
Would that be ethical or unethical?
No, ethical or unethical, I just think it would be ineffective.
I want to say just one more
principle of persuasion, and that is try to maintain a sense of humor in these discussions with individuals. It's really, really difficult. I want to repeat a joke that my father said recently, which I thought was very funny. We were sitting at a family dinner, and my extended family has become very supportive of those of us who are vegetarian. And he looked at me and he said, "Are you vegetarian because you love animals or because you hate plants?" And I laughed, and I think it is important for us to laugh at ourselves.
Okay, I want to say something, and that is, all you're saying is absolutely true, but to a point. Like, for example, my favorite show on TV is House. Now, this is an obnoxious doctor here, but what I really like about him is his bluntness and his blunt honesty. He just says it like it is for him. And to me, I like that kind of approach from a person, that kind of honesty, nitty-gritty honesty, rather than all the PC dancing around trying to be, all very kind and respectful of people's feelings. Like, it's like, just tell me how it is.
Thank you a lot. And thank you, Eleanor, for being on the... Can we have just a little tune, and then we're going to be over to Ollard and Howard Lyman, who will be calling in about 8 minutes' time. So over to Alan and a bit of levity.
That's a bit of music from Rumba Calzada, one of the groups that's here for the Jazz Festival this weekend. The Jazz Festival starts today, and don't forget, tomorrow and Sunday there are free concerts in Gastown, and it might be a little wet, but the music will be great. And Co-op Radio is going to have a table down there, so you want to visit Co-op Radio, you can do that down in the Gastown part of the Jazz Festival. Free concerts all day tomorrow and Sunday at the Jazz Festival in Gastown, and there's also all kinds of other Jazz Festival things happening. Now, back to Carl.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on our favorite station, Co-op Radio. Our webpage is coopradio.org, and our Animal Voices is animalvoices.org. Well, Ollart is involved in the film industry and the health industry. And as we've heard from Eleanor this morning, semantics and how we say things is really important in conveying a message. And you're also involved with linguistics somehow or other. So over to you.
Oh, thank you, Carl. Yeah, I like to pay attention to words because I think they're really indicative of the way the person really thinks about things. And people don't pay a lot of attention to their choice of words and how much they're revealing by their choice of words. Also their actions, too. And actually, before I get into the language thing, I just want to preface this with a couple of little stories, because these stories reveal, just by people's actions even, their attitudes towards animals. For example, I was going to tell you this story last time when you were talking about fishing. There was a fellow that I'd met, and he had wanted to date me, and so we were talking on the phone at one point. He was talking about he liked to go fishing, and being a vegetarian, I said, oh, so you like to fish and eat fish? And he said, well, no, I don't eat them. I catch them, and then I let them go. And I said, well, what for? And he said, well, for the sport of it, for fun. I said, so don't you think that that's a little cruel? And he said, what's cruel about it? And I said, well, when you're pulling that hook from the fish's mouth, and you don't think that that's painful for the fish? Oh, they don't feel anything, he says. And I said, so when you see that blood coming out of its mouth, when you remove the hook, and you see that fish thrashing like mad in the water as you're reeling it in, you don't think it's traumatized, you don't think it's in pain, you don't think it's frightened, you think it's perfectly okay, and they don't feel anything. And he said, yeah. Well, of course, by the end of the conversation, he thought I was fairly obnoxious, and you know what I thought of him. But and that was the end of him. There was no way I was going to date somebody that insensitive, you know. If he's that insensitive to animals, do I want him in my life? I don't think so. I mean, which also then reminds me of somebody who I did barely knew, who sent me a photograph. It's like I barely said a few words to him, but for some reason he got my address, I guess from a friend. He sent me a photograph of himself standing next to, I think it was like a buck, like a deer buck, you know, with the horns and everything. And he had shot this thing, and he was standing by it, and I thought, I don't even know this guy. What is he really trying to say to me? Well, what he's really trying to say is that I'm a man. You should be impressed with me. I took down this big game, you know. I'm therefore better and bigger than this big game.
From
and you
a
should
mile
just,
away.
You know, should be rushing into my arms wanting to be with me. Anyways, that didn't go over with me either. I watched two now. This program last Saturday that I endured, and it was a fishing program. Now, here I'm getting into the language, but I wanted to preface this with these other stories. I wanted to pay attention to the language that these men were using as they were sport fishing. They were sport fishing, yes, they were letting the fish go, but their whole game, it was a competition, and the competition was the bigger the fish was that they caught, the more points they got from it. So, as they were catching these fish, all I noticed in their language was they talked about how big the fish was. Again, men, size seems to matter. Okay, how big the fish was and how hard it fought before they brought it down. This was the only kind of language that went on from fish to fish to fish. So when they lifted up the fish after that fish thrashed like mad and fought like mad, and they're going, look, that's the size of this thing, and I'm sitting there thinking, they're not talking about how beautiful the coloring is on this fish. They nowhere do they ever mention, geez, I wonder what this fish is feeling and thinking right now. And while we were reeling in, I wonder if it's got a, you know, if it has friends. I wonder what the psychology of this, no talk of any of that, just how big it was and how hard it fought back. So again, it was the same mentality as the person who sent me the photograph. Oh, I'm a big man. The bigger the fish and the harder it fought, the bigger a man he was for having taken it down. So now when it comes to language, I have noticed that the language that we use when we're talking to people really reflects a lot of our attitude towards animals. There are numerous animal names that we use to call each other, and they're usually insults. Whether we call a person a dog, a cow, a nag. There's many names that are used for women. Bitch, nag, sow, cow, you know, fox, some chicken, you know, chick, all these
fox
things.
Fox is good.
Pardon me?
Fox is good.
Fox is good. Well, yeah, but foxes are in some languages, fox means sexy. In some languages, it means sly, cunning, deceitful. Right. So I downloaded a list of
animal names from the net in various languages. And, for example, under chicken, chicken in various languages is thought of as a coward. You know, chicken, you're chicken. It's a coward. So now this poor animal has been saddled with this derogatory term. And a cow, well, it's usually thought of as being cow, as fat, and usually applied to a woman. And often it is attached to the word stupid cow, or fat cow, or something like that. The same with whale, or rhinoceros, or elephant. These are fat. When they call a person this, they're calling them fat. Derogatory terms. When I've got under here, they've got guinea pig and rabbit, both in various languages, says a volunteer for an experiment. You're going to like that,
volunteer,
John, huh?
Okay.
Volunteer for an experiment. Mm-hmm. So this is the attitude towards guinea pigs and rabbits. Rats, of course, are thought of as sneaky and treacherous and
dirty.
Yeah, and we've got donkeys. Donkeys, of course, are thought of as stupid. Snakes, of course, are thought of as treacherous as well. So we have all these animal names that are used to describe people in derogatory terms. Now, one of the things, too, I want to say as well to add to this picture is that our general attitude towards animals, not only with the stories that I told in the beginning, but just even with our pets, we think of them as something we possess. Whether it's our dog, we are animal owners. It's not that they cohabitate or that we're caretakers. We are animal owners. And that's an important word, because then it tends to make it feel all right to subjugate these creatures. We decide when they eat, when they go for a walk, unless you live with a cat, because then they own the house. But, you know, most of our animals, we own them and we have an attitude of ownership over them. When we use these kinds of derogatory terms attached to animals to describe people, then it makes it easier to subjugate people. Because the attitude towards animals is ownership, possession, the ability to use them in any way we feel. So if you then call a person some animal name of some sort, then it makes it easier to subjugate them, to use them, to put them down, to control them. And even if somebody says in the most kindest and sweetest of ways, what a nice chick you are, or what a pretty chick you are, it's like there's still something dehumanizing about the term. And it makes it easier then to assume the right of access to this chick or this person now, because they've been on a subconscious level reduced, dehumanized to an animal level, and the general attitude towards animals is that you can possess, access them, you know, control them. So, and of course, we have the female body parts, which I won't even say what they are, the animal terms for some female body parts, which of course then make certain men think that it's all right then to access and use those body parts because they've now been reduced to certain animal terms. So I think it's really important, the language that we use to talk to each other, because it reflects our attitudes towards animals. And if our attitudes towards animals is derogatory, and in using those terms, it's derogatory towards people, then if we want to develop more respect for one another, even as human beings, then we must learn to refrain from using these kinds of words and terms, derogatory terms with animals. We must refrain from calling people dogs or bitches or chickens or cows or, you know, snakes or rats or things like that.
Does every culture do this?
Every culture seems to do that. You know, I mean, I've
even
got...
Even Aboriginal cultures.
Oh, well, I don't know. I can't speak for every culture. I can only talk about, I've downloaded a list, you know, like when I said chicken here, in English, Spanish, and Catalan, it means coward. In Portuguese, it means an overly protective mother. You know, in Russian, it means evil and egotistical. So in many languages, it's derogatory. At any rate, the point that I wanted to get to was that if we can refrain from calling people animal names, then we will develop more respect not only for each other, but for the animals as well.
Okay, thank you a lot for your wise words. And we'll just have a little touch of music, and we've got Howard Lyman coming up. We'll be talking about soil depletion and agriculture. So over to Alan. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Many of our programs are listed on our webpage, animalvoices.org. And we are here by the courtesy of Co-op Radio, the good people that make it all happen, make Animal Voices happen. Well, Howard Lyman was a fourth-generation family farmer in Montana for almost 40 years. He was involved in agriculture at a time when the call dictated getting bigger and better or getting out. He is the author of the books Mad Cowboy and No More Bull, and he was the star in the DVD called No More Bull. Welcome to Animal Voices, Howard Lyman.
Oh, it's a joy to be with you this morning.
Well, 15 years ago, when you first came to Vancouver, you spoke about topsoil depletion, and I still feel that it's one of the aspects that are not very widely covered, and you have so much experience with this whole topsoil depletion. What would you consider to be one of the main causes of this the destruction of topsoil?
Well, I think, Carl, that there's no doubt about it that the reason that we're losing as much topsoil as we are, and if we look at the total of it, you know, the boat people have only been in North America a little over 300 years. When they landed, we had the deepest, richest topsoil of any place on the face of the earth. In 300 years, we have lost 75%. Just stop and think about it. Three quarters of all of the topsoil that was here when the boat people arrived 300 years ago is gone. It takes about 500 years to produce an inch of topsoil. We haven't been here long enough to produce an inch, and we lost three quarters of what we have. The reason that we've lost the topsoil is because we are involved in monoculture. We're growing thousands and thousands of acres of one crop, and when that crop is removed, then the land is as bare, as open to the elements. The wind comes in and takes thousands of tons of topsoil off. With the wind, with the rain comes down, it washes off. If we look in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, the Mississippi River is depositing billions and billions of tons of topsoil that are washing off of the central part of North America. Now, this is soil that it took millions and millions of years to build up. It is the mainstay of producing the food for the ever-increasing number of people that we are trying to feed. And so here we are with something that is happening. The famous German philosopher Goethe said, we hide everything in plain sight. How many of the listeners do we have today that ever stop and think about the basic of our building block, of our food supply, our topsoil is out there? Do we stop and think about it? Are we concerned about it? Do we see where our government is involved in making things happen that we will rebuild the topsoil? Look at China, for example. The society there for thousands and thousands of years have been farming the same soil. In China, it is much different in the way they are treating the topsoil. There, it's about building it up, making sure that there's more at the end of one generation than there was when they started farming it a generation before. We are not doing that in North America. We're not doing that in most of the places in the world. And, Carl, I could not agree with you more. I think it is the most unthought of, difficult problem that we have, and one that can actually take this Homo sapiens species and make them extinct if we don't wake up.
Now, you spoke about monoculture, but what role has fertilizers played in this topsoil destruction?
Well, you know, when you stop and think about it, when you're a farmer, nature's fertilizer is a thing that is called compost. It is crop aftermath that is broken down, reincorporated into the soil, that builds it up, that gives the food for all of the life forms in the soil, that makes it richer and more valuable. we've come up with this idea that we can just go and take petrochemicals and we can turn them into food source for plants, and that we don't have to worry about building up the soil, that we don't have to worry about compost, that we can do everything quickly. And by putting this chemical fertilizer on, we are circumventing one of the most important things in the world, which is building up the soil, incorporating the crop aftermath into it. And so monoculture, using the chemical, petrochemical fertilizers, is just a terrible disaster. It's a recipe that could be the end of the earth.
Now, you've said some 75% of the topsoil has been destroyed in the last since agriculture has changed in North America, but so maybe 25% left now, and it's continuing, is it, or is there an abatement in the rate of soil depletion here?
Well, there is some good news. There is an abatement at the rate of depletion. But the fact of it is, we have not stopped the destruction of our topsoil. We're still going in the wrong direction. We're not going as fast in the long direction as we did a few years ago. But let's take a look at something that every one of us in North America is aware of, and that is that we have denuded the mountains with the trees that were there. Almost all of the ancient forest is gone. If you go up in an airplane and you fly over North America, you will see millions and millions of acres that have been clear cut. That's open to the whims of nature. They're washing off topsoil. And remember, the mountains, there's a lot of places where they only have maybe an inch or 2 inches of topsoil on the entire thing, and that can be lost in one storm. So we're not losing topsoil at the rate that we were a few years ago, but we're still losing it at a rate the future is looking very, very dim.
So we have a lot of this topsoil. It's gushing down into the rivers and it's going into the oceans. And maybe you can just enlarge a bit on what it's doing, what is going down there from the agricultural heartland of North America, which basically I think we're talking about the Mississippi, the other rivers, the Colorado maybe, up to you. What's it doing to the ocean where these rivers are flowing in?
Well, it's an amazing thing. If we go off of New Orleans, where the Mississippi River runs into the Gulf of Mexico, we have an area that is larger than the state of Massachusetts that is absolutely, totally dead. We're talking about no oxygen in an area of that size because of the topsoil, the herbicides, the pesticides that are washing off, that the nothing can live within that area. You know, when you get out a map and take a look at an area as large as the state of Massachusetts and place it in the Gulf of Mexico, all of a sudden you understand the magnitude of how much of that body of water is not available for growing any kind of food for the fish. When you look at the concern that we have on the West Coast here right now with the loss of salmon, much of the loss of the salmon is directly related to the water washing off of the spawning grounds, making the habitat impossible for the fish to come back and lay their eggs so that we can end up growing a new crop of salmon. These are directly related to the way that we are treating the ground, and whether we're talking about the way we're farming or the way that we're dealing with our forest, those things are directly related. And how that runoff is going into the area of the spawning grounds, it's going into the area that's producing the food that feeds billions of people.
Without going into too much detail, I'm just intrigued by this gigantic area of ocean that is literally dead and lacking of oxygen. But nature always has a way of producing oxygen, and it's in the air. What is the mechanism here that there's no oxygen there for the fish, like you mentioned?
Well, what we're seeing is when we're washing off the amount of topsoil, herbicides and pesticides that are going there. The main thing in the ocean that oxygenates it is when we're looking at plankton. When the plankton cannot get the sunlight to go into the water to allow that to grow, to use up the nutrients that are in the water, it is the water is so embedded with soil, herbicides, pesticides, that it is reflecting the sunlight. Without the sunlight, the plankton is not growing. Without the plankton growing, they're not oxygenating the water, and it is a cycle that is going on that is getting worse and worse every day. This area, Carl, as we're talking about it, is not shrinking. We're not on top of it. It's not getting better. It's getting worse, even though we have started to change the way we're farming in much of the central part of the United States, that we are not going and leaving as much soil bare as what we did. Look at the example in the state of Iowa. In the state of Iowa, there was a church, and this church was built in 1850. From 1850 till today, that church has been in continuous use 157 years. When they built the church in 1850, they took a picture and they placed it up on the wall. All of the land around that church was farmed. 157 years later, they decided to take another picture. They took it, put it up on the wall. All of the land was farmed still around that church. But the difference is that the church today sits 10 feet higher than all of the land that's around it. In 157 years, Carl, in that one area in Iowa, they lost 10 feet of topsoil. Nobody, one year to the next, came and said, "Ooh, look, we lost a quarter of an inch of topsoil." But slowly, they lost 10 feet of topsoil in 157 years, and I'm telling you that we are still losing it today. We have not corrected the problems that are out there of the magnitude that has the potential to end up starving billions of people around the face of the earth.
Howard, I just wanted to say something about the vicious circle. I just noticed on a news item we had on the news, the TV news yesterday, they were talking about a city in China called Linfen, I think it's called, Linfen. That city has, there's so much industry that's moved there that the CO2 production is so extreme that the smog there is so intense people can barely see anything from one building to the next across the street. And one of the farmers there said, I mean, well, first of all, one of the women that they asked, they said, "When was the last time you saw blue sky?" And she thought for a moment. She said, "I don't remember." They asked a farmer, you know, about his crops, and he said, "How can anything grow here? You can't. The sun doesn't come through. You can't. The air is bad. You know, when you're talking about oxygen, so it becomes a vicious circle too. The more we pollute our environment, we're not helping the soil either that way."
Well, you know, you look at China, which is fully one-sixth of all of the people on the face of the earth. One out of every three people in China today are dying from the air they're breathing and the water they're drinking. It is the most polluted country on the face of the earth today. They have done wonders over thousands of years of building up their soil, and they've completely forgot about how to keep their air clean and end up with clean water. And so it's not just one thing. It's about realizing how to live within the environment. It is, what do we do? You know, we take the listeners that are out there today, and they're looking at it, and they're saying, "Boy, I sure wouldn't do something like that." But ask yourself this question. Every time you pull out your dollar, every time you spend it, every time you buy it, you're voting on the future. Was the thing that you bought produced correctly? When we're looking at food, was the food that you bought produced organically? Was it done as nature intended? Or are you subsidizing the chemical, petrol, agricultural system that we have out there today that is destroying our topsoil?
Well, that was so one... Sorry to interrupt.
It's not just up to the farmer. It's up to the consumer that's out there that you have to make sure that you're voting with your dollar so that there is a bright future.
Well, and that's exactly right. And this is one of the things that was said on this news item is that they had somebody from China saying, well, you know, you over in the West or in the United States, whatever, you've moved all your industry to China because it's cheaper for you to produce here. And that's what's releasing all the CO2 in the air. But then you blame us for the pollution. So we have to take some responsibility for what we're creating, what we're sending over there, and what we're
I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think we are the problem. You know, you cannot point at somebody else and tell them that they're the problem. You have to look at where are you in this system. And until you start living within the confines of the environment, you're part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Howard, I have a question as well. Eleanor here. It seems that some of the issues you're describing tie in some of the issues we discussed earlier regarding the livestock industry. Certainly the United Nations report in outlining the many environmental problems caused by the livestock industry pointed out that we must all as a society begin to price natural resources properly in a way that reflects their true environmental cost. We have been allowing in many, many sectors large corporations to use water, land, especially water, and other resources as if free or for such low prices that they do not reflect their real cost. And, of course, returning these to society in a degraded or a polluted form, which also should not be allowed. Certainly the livestock industry uses tons of water. It should be priced properly. Do you think that that's relevant to the topsoil issue?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I spent 40 years of my life in animal production, and I will tell you that what we're doing in North America today is absolutely, totally non-sustainable. It is being subsidized by the taxpayer that's out there. If it was not for the government subsidies today, you would see where a burger, instead of selling for $1 or $2, you would see them selling for $12 or $14. We have an economy that is totally out of whack, that is being jacked around by politicians and big money resources that are there. I think the United Nations, when they came out with a report on global greenhouse gases and the involvement of livestock, took the first major step in out there putting the blame where it belongs. The agricultural industry worldwide today needs to be reformed. You know, not only are we destroying our resources with the animal agriculture, we're out there absolutely destroying human health. When you look at the fact that the 6 out of every 10 North Americans today are considered to be overweight or obese, 1 out of 2 dying of heart disease, 1 out of 3 having cancer, 1 out of 4 dying of cancer, and every one of those problems directly related to the consumption of animal protein. There can be nothing that would be more true than we would say that if we corrected a large part of our problem tomorrow, if we erased animal agriculture from North America tomorrow, we would probably reduce global greenhouse gases just by what we do in North America by 10% overnight.
Howard, much of the rationale for genetic modification of plants is to make them herbicide resistant. What is this obsession with getting rid of weeds, and how did we deal with it before, and why are we dealing with it in this chemical way today?
Well, first thing that we have to look at is, what do you determine to be a weed? A weed is nothing more than a plant that we consider to be out of place. Nature has a way of growing things in the proper relationship that they control plants that are out of place. But when we go to monoculture, chemically controlled agriculture, and what we're saying is we're going to take millions and millions of acres and eliminate everything except one crop that is growing there, what I have to do is you have to go out with a chemical and kill everything except that the one that you have. So they genetically modify a plant that will grow with being sprayed with this chemical, and it will kill everything else. This is the most asinine approach to food production, to the care of our environment, of anything that I could ever imagine. And, you know, the man that came up with propaganda, Joseph Goebbels from the Germany in World War II, he said, find the biggest lie you can find and tell it often enough and people will start to believe it. Well, genetically engineered crops and controlling them with chemicals so that we can get involved in monoculture is absolutely suicidal for the future. And I don't see anybody within government today that has a clue of what's happening, and it just worries me to death.
Yeah, and in fact, they build this as a green solution to... It's amazing how corrupt the human mind can become.
There was another thing, too, and I read it in a book somewhere. I wish I could remember the author. But with regards to pesticides, I mean, she said, you know, the pesticides are there to kill the bugs. Well, all we are really is just big bugs. And so it just kills us slower, that's all.
They say when you look at a plant, if the bugs aren't eating it, maybe you shouldn't be trying to eat it either, because they stay away from the ones that aren't edible, and those are the ones that we're eating.
Now, this awareness of climate change certainly is quite positive. And I'd like to just end on a positive note here, because you've already said that we need to be aware of what we're consuming and what is being produced locally. What effect is it having on climate change on the topsoil, like we're having greater storms, greater climatic changes? So some areas are going to be more wet, some areas are going to be drier. But what effect is that going to have on the... Is there going to be a balancing out here in the future? Maybe you can put on your little visionary cap here.
Well, I think the first thing we want to look at, Carl, is there's absolutely no doubt that we have global warming. We can argue about how it happens, how fast it's happening, but there is no doubt global warming is happening. If we look at just a couple of things that are out there, if we look at diseases that are moving from the equator north because of the change in the temperatures that are there, we are seeing millions and millions of acres and animals that are no longer protected because the diseases are moving north. We are also seeing that the growing season, the amount of temperature that allowed plants to grow within a certain band of area, that area is changing to the point that the varieties that were growing are no longer optimum the way they were. And so we're seeing things moving further north. One in global greenhouse problem, it is that weather is more violent. You know, we may end up with the same amount of rain in an area in a year's time that we got before, but we might find that the majority of that comes in one or two storms. Will that amount of moisture in those one or two storms provide the amount of food that we need? I came from Montana. My father told me when I was growing up that in all of the years that he was there, that you could bet that there would be more days of rain in June than days that it didn't rain. When I finished farming in Montana in the 80s, I saw many, many years that we could count on one hand the number of days where it rained in June. Without those June rains, you did not end up with the crop that you were producing coming to its ultimate value. And so I would say right now, the greatest threat that we have right now is Homo sapiens' inability to understand that there are things that we can do to mitigate what is happening. And until we do that, each of us individually, then we're going to continue to see higher temperatures. We're going to see loss of greater amount of topsoil, less clean air, less clean water. So there's some amazing things that need to be done. But it starts with each and every one of us.
Howard, you say it so well, and we're right out of time. We're deeply gratified to have deep gratitude to you for being on our show. Maybe you can give us your web page, because we have no more bull books to sell, and some of your DVDs. Maybe give us your web page.
Yeah, my web page is madcowboy.com, and I would highly recommend everybody read my first book, Mad Cowboy, in the 12th printing now, translated in Polish, Korean, Japanese, and Chinese, and my new book, No More Bull. Those can help you start on the path of being from part of the solution and not the problem.
Thank you, Howard Lyman. And yes, you've been listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Thank you for listening.